Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 10th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Cheryl Ney. Today's session number is 98-4, and it's titled Molecules in Action, Reactions and Interactions in Fire and Water. Let's listen in.
Okay, Master. What we've been doing this week is working on using chemical perspective to look at nature here at Holden Village. And so today we want to use the chemical perspective to look at molecules in action, particularly relating to fire and water. So what we have to do now is we'll have to either help you build up a pair of chemical lenses if you don't already own one, or if you already have a pair of chemical lenses, you can take them out of their case and polish them off here as we work with other people who need to build them up. After we help you all develop a pair of lenses to look at the world with, then we'll work on developing two important focals for the lens so that we can look at some properties of nature. And then after we get those focals developed, then we'll actually use those focals on those lenses to look at combustion, and if time allows, we'll look at Railroad Creek, if we can. And then, of course, we need to end by connecting to the village theme guide our feet. All right, so I really like to think about this knowledge in chemistry as a way of looking at the world. And so I think the metaphor of having a pair of chemical lenses is a really useful one. So if you wear contact lenses or you wear glasses, you know what it's like when you put on a pair of lenses. All right, so I want you to, in your mind, think of putting on a pair of frames. If you already have chemical lenses, you can already begin to peer through those lenses in the frame, but if you don't have those chemical lenses, things should look pretty blurry. How many people think they have some kind of a chemical lens here, so I know how far back I need to develop? Okay, so we've got some people with lenses and some people not. So for those of you who are already seeing the world through chemical lens, you can help me as we work through this. All right, so if you're going to develop a chemical lens, really the first thing you need to do is the following. I'll work down here. So there you are with your lens. The very first thing you do when you look through a pair of chemical lenses is you realize that everything, all matter, all stuff, whether it be living or non-living, is composed of atoms and molecules. All right, so this is a significantly different way of looking at the world. Right? That means the person sitting next to you is composed of atoms and molecules. It means the chair you're sitting in is composed of atoms and molecules. All right? Just a little refresher. Remember, the atoms are considered the smallest building block of stuff, material stuff, living stuff, and non-living stuff that chemists care about anyway. So if you're a physicist, we're not going to get into subatomic particles or anything like that. To the chemist, we can break down material to an atom, and that's a good enough starting material. Somebody in an earlier session was telling me they've been reading the book Sophie's World, and in that book there's a young girl, and to her the world is described as being composed of little tiny, teeny Legos. Right? So if Legos is part of your world, and that's a good metaphor for a building block, you can think of atoms as being teeny, tiny, eeny, meeny, indivisible Legos. All right? So now, as you're looking through your lens, you're thinking about everything made of atoms and molecules, and those atoms being the building block. Just a couple more things here to help us begin to see things. And that is, you may remember that atoms are joined through bonds to form molecules. So molecules are a bigger form of this material. So you can think of it as building up those Legos or something like that. And then finally, if we're going to use the metaphor of lens, we really have to help our visual image. All right, we have to help our eyes. And so the way chemists can do that is they represent atoms by spheres. We know that there are many different atoms, all right, depending on when you count in history. Now we're up to 100 and something something atoms. And so we represent those different atoms by colored spheres. Right, so for example, in water with H2O, we've got the hydrogen here represented in blue, the hydrogen atom and the oxygen atom represented in red. All right, so using spheres, I think, can help you quite a bit. Right, any questions or comments that you would want to add to the lens here as we now try to look and see the world? Anything about that that you need some clarification on or wonder about? All right, so let's just take a moment to see what we can see when we do that. Here's a pot of water up here. You all know about H2O. Here I've got an example of colored spheres. So the white sphere would be which atom here?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, and the red atom would be oxygen. So now put your chemical lens on and peer into my pot of water, and can't you see those molecules? Right? What do we have to do in order to actually see those water molecules? We're going to have to blow them up to be pretty big, right? Because those water molecules we really can't see with our naked eye. What we're trying to do, of course, is see with our heads. All right. So why don't you all take a moment, pick an object. Person in your group, your shoe, the carpet, why don't you take a moment and see what happens when you try to see something, some stuff, through this chemical lens. Why don't you share with each other what you see? See what happens.
You get it.
All right. Sounds like you're all getting started. Any questions or comments? Any questions come to mind as you look in the at the world in this way? Absolutely. No questions at all. Any questions you have as you try to look at the world as a chemist?
How big are the...
No, that's right. No, go ahead.
How big are the largest molecules? How many atoms are we talking
about? Oh my gosh. Molecules in living systems, of course, are very complicated. So, hundreds.
I mean, is a compound a molecule?
A compound is a molecule.
So we've got H2O, which is...
A teeny tiny, weeny molecule, right, compared to like a protein, like a hemoglobin.
And so in its smallest form, what would the largest molecule be?
Oh, the largest molecule? You know, I don't really know. No one's ever asked me that before.
Thousands or
hundreds? Your DNA has got 3 billion base pairs in it, and the base pairs maybe have about, I'm going to guess here, 40 atoms in the base pair, so 120 billion atoms in your human DNA. How's that?
That's
good. Big, right?
You can't tell us how many molecules per gallon or anything like that.
We could do a calculation.
We could.
Let's see.
Weigh it.
Yeah. How quick? 55 grams per mole of water. So if we took 55 milliliters of water, that would represent 1 mole of water, which would be 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd water molecule.
It's a big number.
23 to 0 exactly.
So 50 mils of water would be about 6 right. times 10 to the 23rd molecule. So we're talking, of course, when I ask you to look in there and see those water molecules, it's really important.
Now, I remember my high school chemistry teacher saying that 1 mole of peas would cover the earth like 13 feet.
Wow. That's the unit of measure in chemistry.
A mole.
Yeah, a mole. 6 times 10 to the 23rd.
Well, looking at this, is this organic?
Yeah, carbon-based straw, so it'd be carbon-based.
What about plastic?
In terms of what?
What about plastic?
Most plastics are carbon-based. So they have, and they would be, in fact, we could probably find plastics bigger than a DNA molecule. Because those are very large molecules. All right, so there's definitely something happens when you think about the world from a chemical perspective. Let's enhance your vision here by providing a little more detail. We don't have time to look at all the M's on the periodic chart, nor can I help you with that. I'm a biochemist, so those metal atoms are way beyond me. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, that's me. All right, so let's pick an atom, and let's pick a model for that atom. All right, so we don't have time to talk about all the models we have for atoms. Let's pick a model. It's often given the name Bohr. That's the person who first developed the model. More commonly, as it's taught in the grade schools, you might recall it's called the shell model. All right, and the model for the atom, let's take a carbon atom. And we want to pick carbon because, as we've said, every living thing has carbon as part of its composition. All right, so you can imagine then that, let's think about this wood. I'm going to try to reach in here and pull out a carbon atom. If I could reach in here and pull out a carbon atom and then cut it in half, this might be what we would see. All right, so you may remember that a carbon atom has 6 protons, positively charged, and we find those in the nucleus, along with the neutrons, but we're not doing nuclear chemistry, so we forget the neutrons, we'll just think about the 6 protons. And then what happens is there's a vast space, and then we start to get shells. Right? And in our first shell, we have 2 electrons, and you may remember in this model, the electrons have random wild motion, and so they're revolving around the nucleus here. And in fact, with this picture, you have some idea about why these electrons would stay in this shell. What's going to hold electrons in an atom? Mm-hmm. Electrons are negatively charged. What's going to hold them there?
Proton.
Right, positive charge. So it's an electrical attraction that keeps things together here. And then, as part of this model, as the way to explain carbon in the early 20th century, we put another shell outside of that one, and we then put 4 more electrons in that shell. All right, so in the end, this shell model could be described metaphorically. You could think of it as an onion, right? You cut down an onion, and you open the onion, you see that hard center. So there's your nucleus, and then each layer of skin would be your electron shells. All right, so here we're talking about carbon, so that means we're down thinking about those little tiny, like martini onions. Right? That's a carbon atom. And if we were to think about uranium, you could think of those as a big Vidalia onion, right? Lots of shells in those big onions, all right? So now we're talking about the carbon atom. So why don't you take a minute to focus in on something that's organic and look at your chemical, look through your chemical lens and see if you can pick out some carbon atoms and take a moment to get it clear in your mind what you're looking at when you see a carbon atom. So why don't you talk that over with each other here as a way of getting the vision good.
Well, that's sure. Anything with carbons, anything living is organic. Anything living is carbon.
Just don't ruin my world by sharing it.
And even some things that weren't living.
It's mostly water, carbon.
Plastics have carbon.
All right, so we've got a lot of living stuff in this room. There's lots of carbon atoms, right? We're teeming with carbon atoms, right? And now you, as a chemist, you can imagine those carbon atoms in you and in other living things. Questions or comments about what happens when you look at carbon?
So organic is defined as contain a carbon atom. So water is not organic. It's not, or?
That's correct. The definition of organic is carbon containing. And then what happens is you get carbon containing in test tubes, mm-hmm. like the folks in the research lab or the pharmaceutical companies, those scientists are working with carbon in the test tube. And so then you split off between organic and biochem, because then you'd be talking about carbon in living things, mm-hmm. and that would be bio. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments about carbon?
I take it there are some molecules where the where there's an imbalance between the protons and electrons. And what happens there?
All right, there are some atomic species where you can have electrons, remember, given or taken away.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you get ions. So table salt, for example, is composed of the sodium ion and the chloride ion. And you get that because atoms are driven somehow to fill their electron shells. So this second shell should have 8 electrons in it, and carbon gets its shell filled by taking on 4 electrons. But yeah, so we have ionic species as well. And then we checked in with Rick yesterday, the geologist, and confirmed that we should not forget that there are forms of carbon in rocks, like carbonates in rocks. Diamond is carbon, right? So there are some forms of inorganic things that have carbon as well. All right, well, let's bump up our focus here on carbon, and I'd like to show you a video image of a model for a carbon atom. All right, so what we're going to do is now zoom in and get sort of a more dynamic, three-dimensional, moving picture of the carbon atom. All right, so as you watch the video, I'd really like for you to try to compare it to this model over here and see what you can remember. Okay, I'm going to hit the lights so we can fully experience the carbon atom. We're going to take a trip from the outside of the shell into the carbon nucleus. So let's see.
One place group of three hydrogen atoms bonded by electrical forces to a carbon atom. 4 electrons make up the outer shell of the carbon itself. They appear in quantum motion as a swarm of shimmering points. At 10 to the minus 10 meters, 1 angstrom, we find ourselves right among those outer electrons. Now we come upon the 2 inner electrons held in the tighter swarm. As we draw toward the atom's attracting center, we enter upon the vast inner space. At last, the carbon nucleus. So massive and so small, this carbon nucleus is made up of 6 protons and 6 neutrons. We are in the domain of universal modules. There are protons and neutrons in every nucleus, electrons in every atom, atoms bonded to every molecule out to the farthest galaxy. As a single proton fills our seed, we reach the edge of present understanding. Are these some quarks in intense interaction? Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of 10. If now the field is 1 unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
All right, so there you have sort of a moving dynamic picture, and what represented the electrons in that image, in that model?
The fuzzy
little white dots, right? You can imagine as if we're putting a light tag on the electrons and just kind of following the electron around, right? And then, of course, the other nice thing about that image is that you see that vast space here where there's nothing. The electron clouds don't move in too close to that nucleus, right?
If we were to compare that distance with the solar system, say, how many light years away would that?
I really don't know.
A vast space. It's really far.
It's 2 powers of 10.
2 powers of 10.
Yeah.
It's like, my chemistry teacher said, it's like if you stick a pea in the middle of a football field, then the electrons would be around the outer edge of the stadium. So there's
the first,
all that space in between the nucleus, which is the pea in the center of the football field, and then
that's a good one. And you remembered it. That's great. Great. All right. So there's a good metaphor for you.
Okay.
So now you can see what's happening. Each time you take an idea, what's happening to your vision? All right. Why don't you take a moment again to focus in on find a carbon atom somewhere. I'll remind you about where some are. Just put out a stream of carbon atoms for you. Sure.
We're talking about the smallest thing here, the molecule of the atom itself.
Yeah.
Having this vast space in it.
Right.
So what we can really say is that the world is made up mostly of nothing.
You blow me out.
I mean, it looks, even the air is made up of mostly nothing.
Can I answer that?
Yeah, go ahead.
That question, that is the philosophical
question.
I asked that very question to the chemistry professor one time. Near dry, yeah.
Okay.
It's nothing, it's more, what's there?
It's mostly.
So in every month, there's a.
Why do you have very good answers for you?
Because it's held in a gravitational orbit, you know, and then beyond that, there's no electrons. But between the center and the electrons is a huge space. Then the electrons would be on the outside. That's how much space there is between the center and the electrons. So what that means is that every molecule inside of you is mostly.
What a beautiful explanation. That was really wonderful. All right, so I think now we're ready to go on. We've got the basics. You all get the idea that everything, all matter, is composed of atoms and molecules. Right? The next step then is, of course, we know from our own experience that things happen to stuff. Right? Think about the copper ore that came out of the ground there. What happened to that stuff? Well, they treated it and got it down into some kind of concentrated form, right? What other things can we think of happens to stuff? I listed a few out here. Food rots, right? Something happened to those molecules in food, make it rot. When you take red paint and mix it with blue paint, you get yellow paint. Something happened to that stuff, all right? So we all know from our own experience that something happens to atoms and molecules.
Don't you get purple?
Did I say it wrong? Yeah. Oh, I think the colors are wrong. You're right. Thank you. Red and blue is purple. I wrote it down wrong. I just wanted to see if you were thanks. All right, so now that I'm kind of recalling that experience, can you think of anything else that's happening in Holden Village in terms of stuff?
Things grow,
okay. All right, that's good.
Precipitation.
All right, we see rain coming out of the sky. That's good.
Things age.
What's that?
Things burn.
That's another good one.
Things age.
The other direction from growth. All right.
Oxidize.
What's that?
Things oxidize,
right? You walk up the Honeyman Heights Trail and you see that old stuff that's got a lot of rust on it and stuff like that.
Things cook,
mm-hmm. Right? So we know from our own experience that stuff happens to matter. Things happen to stuff. Things happen to matter. Yeah. All right, so now let's put a chemical understanding on that experience. All right, so we're going to put a new focal in your pair of lenses which tells you that the world is composed of atoms and molecules. By asking the question, what's happening to our atoms and molecules when we see these things change? All right, what's happening? It turns out, gratefully, there are only two things happening. It's only one thing or another, and that's it. Which anybody who studies chemistry is very grateful about that. Imagine if there were 10,000 different things that happened to atoms and molecules. It would take you your whole lifetime to fully develop your chemical lens, right? But it turns out that only one of two things could be happening as we look at all those changes to our stuff. And that stuff could be reacting, or the other thing that could happen is you're getting a change in the interactions of molecules in that stuff. Right, and there really is a third category, which is no change, nothing's happening. So atoms and molecules either react, interact, or do nothing. All right, so let's just, let me refresh your memory about what some of these things mean. Remember, reaction means you get some kind of chemical change in which then the stuff changes. So if you have a piece of wood and it burns, that nice brown wood turns into a pile of ash. That would be a chemical change. And a reaction has occurred. Alright? What happens when it rains? Where does the water that comes down as drops, where does that come from?
Mm-hmm.
The clouds. It's up there in a gaseous state. And so it's water as vapor, and then it's water as rain, so it's still water, and that's called a physical change. And what's happened there is something about the interactions. Alright, so let me clarify one more thing about what's going on with molecules. Here I have a model for a methane molecule. We have any methane? Yes, we have lots of methane in Holden Village. From beans and nuts and our human digestion and what we do with those carbon atoms, right? So imagine I grab one of those molecules of methane, right? So methane is composed of carbon with four hydrogens around it. If I wanted to do a reaction with that methane, what would I do? Right? I'd light it, and then I'd be breaking bonds, and I'd make some new bonds. All right. So when material, when stuff takes a different form, then we have a chemical change. All right. Let me also show you with my models the other phenomenon, the other thing that water can do, the other thing that matter can do. I'm going to reach in here and pull out some water molecules.
It just reminded me of something. I've taught biology over the years, and one of the kids in class is a very old one, and about methane gas coming off from humans. This kid said that at some camp, he got his cigarette lighter and actually got a burst of light or flame or something.
Oh, yeah.
The class broke up. I had never heard of that.
Yeah. Be careful, though.
I'll take this light moment to extend that thought. Michael and I, my husband here has done some chemistry. We think we've discovered a new chemical principle up here at Holden Village. Down there, down the mountain, there's a chemical principle called the ideal gas law. You all remember that? PV equals NRT. Up here at Holden, we think it's PV equals F-A. And we keep verifying that principle every morning. Right, so chemical change. The wonderful world of chemical change. Let me just take a minute to illustrate the other thing that matter can do. And I'm just going to reach down into my jar of water here and pull out some water molecules. And in doing that, you'll notice, you see my H2Os, you pick out the, there's the oxygens, and there's the hydrogens and the H2Os, you'll notice that they're sticking together. This is something that atoms and molecules can do, and they do that by molecular Velcro. All right? We can stick our atoms and molecules together by molecular Velcro, which is really nothing more than an electrical attraction. Right, so we use electrical attractions to stick our molecules together. All right, so now you've developed a focal, right? Look out at the world, look at the atoms and molecules. You can say with certainty, I know that those atoms and molecules can do one of two things, right? That someday, or maybe at this moment, the atoms and molecules in my hand are interacting and reacting. All right. The molecules in the carpet interacting and reacting. All right, so now you can go out into your world and look at stuff and say for certain, right? You don't even have to be a PhD in chemistry to say this. You can say, I know that those atoms and molecules can either interact or react. Yeah?
Question.
Yeah?
If you put your hand in water and draw it out, some of the water will come out on your hand.
Right.
But if you put your hand on the carpet and pick it up, none of the carpet will stay on your hand. Tell us why that is.
Let's see.
Is that that cohesion stuff?
I'm not a carpet chemist, but
okay.
I'll try.
Okay.
What I would say would be, these are a solid, so the carpet molecules are sticking together very strongly.
Okay.
And what you can do with your hand is the molecules in your hand can attract the water molecules.
Right.
Which are not sticking together as tightly as the molecoles down there. How does that sound?
Yeah.
Explain interaction, like forming a gas. Because I know, like, if water turns into a gas, then it changes, but it doesn't react. It's interacting, right?
No. What's changing is the degree of interaction.
Okay.
So what I pulled out of the jar there was water in the liquid state.
Right.
And now if I take a candle flame here and heat things up, these will move faster and faster, and in fact the interactions will change, and now all we have are single.
Does it always have to do with the speed of the molecule?
Yes.
Okay.
The heat.
So it either speeds up or slows down.
Right.
Okay.
What happens when it's winter in Holden Village?
slows down.
Right, they slow down.
And what's slowing down?
The motion of the molecules.
The motion of the molecules.
Right? So you saw motion when you saw those electrons moving around, molecules also. Good question. Yeah.
Add something to that. That's why we use refrigeration. When you put the food in the refrigerator, it slows down molecular motions and keeps things from unraveling.
Yeah. Okay. And when things react, the bonds, some bond always breaks, and then
you get maybe some new bonds formed. And so you can, the composition of the stuff changes, all right? So your question is good, it's leading us right into the next question is, okay, so now you can say with certain atoms and molecules are gonna interact or react, how do you know, all right? How can you test, or how can you tell when you get chemical changes or physical changes? So let's think about that for a moment. And why don't we start with the chemical changes? Perhaps those are the easiest. Let's think about a piece of wood. Can't you see the atoms and molecules in my wood? See those, all right? What happens if I light a flame to this piece of wood, presumably? What will happen? It'll burst into flame, and then what will happen to the wood itself? It'll disintegrate, and I'll get a pile of ash, or I'll get some charcoal around the outside of the wood. So the wood, which was like this, becomes blackened. All right. So how can you tell that a chemical reaction has occurred? You can see it. All right. So one kind of change we get with chemical changes is that you can see a change. Color is a good example of the visual. What other kind of visual change can we see in stuff?
Shape.
Shape?
Texture,
that's a good one. Maybe size. Right, our big log gets smaller, right? So there are all kinds of visual changes that we can see, and almost always, but not always, those visual changes can be tied back to a chemical change. So you know, you can say now, I know that the bonds are making and breaking. All right? Any other kind of way that we could detect some kind of change in this? Let's take the example of the fire again. Smoke, you got one. And how do you know that there's smoke? You see it with your eyes?
Actually, we'll tell her what you just
And there's another way. Oh, you said the other way. What's the other way you can tell smoke?
Smell.
You can smell it, right? So smell changes. It's another good way to tell that a reaction has occurred. You open up that refrigerator door after your 2 weeks stay at Holden, right, and you see a smell change, you know that the food in your refrigerator has undergone some kind of chemical reaction. All right,
well, so I always knew where the chem lab was in high school.
Yeah, right. That's right. Walk into any institution, university, you can zoom right in on the science lab. Right? That's good. What other senses could we use to maybe detect a chemical change?
If heat's given up, you can
feel.
All right, so you feel heat. All right, so our wood example would be another example of that. You can hear it, that's right. What's a good example of a hearing change?
The fire crackling.
Okay, popping of the fire, right? Dynamite.
Kaboom.
Right? Chemical change is occurring, right? Let's see, any others?
Thunder,
is that a chemical change?
Alka-Seltzer.
Alka-Seltzer, visit, all right? What about thunder?
Electrically it ionizes the
oxygen. Okay. All right, so thunder would be another example. Fizzing, thunder, right? Would that throw off any of the senses?
Taste,
right? That's kind of a hard one because remember, it has to be change. It has to be a change in taste in order for the reaction to occur. What's that?
If something's rotting.
Or you shouldn't taste
it. Yeah, but if you take the tuna fish and make a sandwich and it's bad.
Okay, so you know what tuna fish should taste like, and then you taste rotted tuna fish, so there's some kind of change, all right? And so you know a chemical reaction is occurring.
Burnt
food, right? You know what unburnt food should taste like. And so, again, we have to stress that it's this change that we're looking for. Can you think of an example where you actually put something in your mouth and the taste changes? And so the reaction occurs while you eat it?
bread gets sweet if you hold it in your mouth long enough.
What's that?
Like bread or crackers or something get tastes sweet if you're chewing for a
while. Hold it in your mouth long enough, okay? So that would be an example. Anybody else think of any other example? What do you, the chemistry is actually going on in here.
Wine.
Uh-huh. So the longer you hold it in your mouth, you're getting reaction with the acid in your mouth or the enzymes or something. Okay, good. Did you have an example?
Oh, just sour stuff.
Okay. Okay, all right. Have we left now any of the senses out? I forgot how many senses are there.
Six.
Five or six.
You can intuit.
Okay. So basically what we can do is, for the most part, it doesn't always work, I should warn you, but for the most part, a sense change is probably a chemical change. So you can say then with certainty, I can see through my lens and I know that I'm getting that sense change because I can see bonds being broken and made. Right? All right, let's talk for a minute about the physical changes. Remember, physical changes, the stuff stays the same. So how are we going to sense, or how are we going to be able to detect when a physical change occurs? What do you think?
Well, you can see some of them.
You can see some of them, right? And what do you actually see?
Well, you can see steam if you burn the water.
Okay, so you can see then gas, liquid, and solid states. And whenever you can visually see that some kind of change occurs, you can say that that's a physical change. Can we use any other sense to detect a physical change? I actually have never thought about this one.
How about, feel?
Because right, because the heat is a physical, the presence or lack of heat is a physical change, so temperature or touch would be.
That's good. So feel a heat change. You'd also have to feel that, let's see, remember a heat change up here would be a chemical reaction, so you'd have to add something else to make sure that it wouldn't make a reaction. A little more complicated. Although I'm sure, imagine that you don't have any one of your senses. Like imagine, let us imagine if we couldn't see, for example. How would we detect that it was raining? Mm-hmm. We would be able to hear it, and we know it was humid outside, we could feel the humidity, so. All right, so now you have an even more powerful way to look at the world. You can use your senses to tie into your chemical lenses. So let's try that with a specific example, and I thought what we would focus on would be combustion. Right? Because as we said up here, we were getting a lot of those changes involving in combustion as we were talking. So let's take a minute to think about combustion and maybe list some examples we have of combustion occurring. Think of a combustion example. We already used wood burning, so that would be one example. What other examples of combustion? Striking a match. I was thinking about that one myself. I think that's actually another kind of reactant. There's some kind of phosphorus on the match head.
But the matchstick burns.
But the matchstick burns.
It's wood burning.
It's wood burning, okay. Other examples of combustion?
Gasoline engine.
Okay, gasoline engine.
And combustion, you define as what again?
Diesel engine.
I wasn't really. maybe something reacting with oxygen. A carbon-containing material reacting with oxygen. No. It would have to be, we can make it broader, because things other than carbon.
How about rusting?
Slow.
Let's restrict ourselves to carbon-containing, because I'm going to get in trouble if we do rusting, because I'm not an inorganic chemist. I'm an organic chemist or biochemist. But let's stick to stuff that has carbon in it. So in a gasoline engine, it's the octane, and remember octane is 8 carbons, right? Other examples of carbon containing. Yeah.
Hay
burning, okay.
What about rocket fuel?
Rocket fuel.
The garbo pit. Diesel.
The garbage pit.
Yeah.
I heard another one. You mentioned diesel back there?
Yeah, also.
What?
Jet engines.
Jet engine fuel, and that would go along with rocket fuel here. What are some other examples we can think of?
What's spontaneous combustion?
Hello, yes.
That's what I meant, but hey.
Hey, oh, you were just talking about something that was far, okay? All right? Okay, any other things you know of that might spontaneously combust?
That happens? I don't know that.
Yeah, did you want to maybe say a word about what you think happens there?
Well, isn't it when it is kept in a tight space and there's too much interaction going on between... And it's like lacking...
Without a spark, hay can ignite.
It can just like blow up on itself.
Because it gets hot?
Because it's hot.
Yeah.
Because of the motion, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, hey, there's some question. The National Enquirer apparently has time to time reported spontaneous human combustion. What's that?
It's always creatures in the
pulpit. Creatures in the pulpit. Okay. I don't mind that.
But like in water.
Kind of like that.
In water for chocolate.
That's
good. Eating those matches.
That's good. Sure.
Yeah. And when you can take a magnifying glass and let the sun start, what kind of a combustion is that?
You're using the radiant energy from the sun to ignite, to provide the sparks. So it was carbon-containing material that you were burning. Right?
Leaves.
Right? Yeah.
How about glucose in our cells?
Okay. Glucose in our cells. Good. We'll see. Oh, yeah. We're going to give you an example of that one in a minute. So we actually combust sugar, and right, we'll talk more about that one in a minute. Let's see, what's being used up here in the kitchen to combust?
Natural gas,
propane, right? Let's see, what did those miners in West Virginia go for? Coal, all right, so we can combust coal. That will be another example. How about in terms of getting a light source? What do we combust to get light besides wood? Which they're frowned upon up here at Holman Village.
What, candles?
Candles, right? Candles, candle wax, oil lamps, right? All right, so you all seem to be quite familiar there with the experience of combustion. Let's see. What I wanted to do was just add some chemistry to combustion. We've talked about examples of combustion. Let's actually look at chemistry that goes on, because now you're all budding chemists, or a budding chemical perspective. So I picked combustion of natural gas, all right? And you'll see that combustion requires oxygen in the presence of a spark, unless it's spontaneously combusting, all right? And the products are, as you remember, carbon dioxide and water, all right? And so, has the methane changed its chemical composition in this process? Started out as methane, ended up as?
Carbon dioxide.
And how did that happen? I mean, what had to happen to the molecule to get from here to here?
Chemical change.
We had to have chemical change. We had to break them bonds, right? And we had to make new bonds. All right, so let's see, I've got it all ready to go out here. So I've got my two oxygen molecules and my methane molecule. And the way chemists understand this combustion is that these molecules come together in a collision. All right, so kaboom, we collide. And then bonds are broken and remade. And out of that, I get my CO2 and my waters. Right? So we know that when complete combustion occurs, the products are carbon dioxide and water. Right? There are a couple other things we can say about the combustion process. One, it illustrates another important principle which you could put on your focal, and that is the law of conservation of matter, of atoms. All right, how many carbon atoms do we start with on this side?
One.
Now, one carbon atom here, how many do we get over here?
One.
One, the form of carbon dioxide. How many hydrogen atoms?
Four.
There they are over there, they didn't disappear. We got four oxygens.
Four
oxygens. So, combustion is nice because it reminds us that atoms are conserved. Right, so when you lose something, what can you say for certain? Those atoms and that stuff that you lost are going to be around forever. Lose your keys, you can rest with certainty that the atoms that are in the keys are not going to get lost.
So where did all the energy come from?
Very good question. We've got chemical energy over here, and so what happens, remember, with energy, we can't make it or lose it for all practical purposes. So what we've done is we've transformed the chemical energy here to a lower form of chemical energy here, and radiant and heat energy.
That's going to pump a bunch of energy in the carbon dioxide and water and make methane nice.
We'd have to pump a whole bunch, and we can't do that yet. Right?
You'd have to add energy to it.
Yeah.
To go back the other way, and we don't.
But it's not possible.
But it's not possible. Too much energy. What made you think of that?
Oh, just going back and forth.
All right. I thought we should continue thinking about combustion by giving an example of combustion here. So I brought some carbon-containing materials with me, which I've kept hermetically sealed in my baggie. Could you verify what kind of stuff this is? What is that? Do you know? Do you recognize that?
No.
Jackson knows.
Pringles.
Pringles, right? Right? And you all are chemists. So to the ordinary person, they're Pringles, but what can we see?
Carbon,
right? Oh, carbon-containing material. Actually, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So let's take a moment to combust my Pringle, if the demonstrator can hang on to them. Without smashing them. All right, so now we need a spark. Oh, we've got something else going on here in the room. What do you see bumping up against my Pringles?
Oxygen.
See those oxygen molecules?
Yeah.
Hopefully they're not too many water molecules, right? I had them hermetically sealed in my bag. Oh, you're worried about.
Did it get away
about,
from it, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
seeing.
Yeah, it's locked in.
Hopefully it won't.
Get it by the door.
So as those oxygen molecules collide with the Pringle, we'll provide a spark here. Right. So we're not humid enough. I've kept these. I think they're not. Usually it goes psh. Might be a little humid in here. These are a little old. But anyway.
Well, usually they flare up the grease.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want to create too much smoke. You get the idea, right? I don't think we should. Right.
There's the sprinkle them off until it's hot.
Is this the when they're fresh?
They're better. I think what happens is you get a layer of water molecules around it, and then they have new barriers in the oxygen.
We want to try it at home.
So yes, the fresher the better. The fresher the better. Almonds work. Material that's really dry, food that's really dry will work. So you can try it at home.
You bet.
You'll be impressed.
Pringles have become a new fad in our house.
All right, there's a particular reason why I picked this combustion, and you've already mentioned that, so let me make the connection here. What we just saw was the combustion of the food, and we've said that combustion produces CO2 and water. All right, what comes out of my mouth when I go like this?
Carbon dioxide and?
Water.
How do you know that water comes out of your mouth when?
Because you're going to vaporize it on a mirror.
All right, you can vaporize it on a mirror, put a cup up to your mouth, all right? So you're producing carbon dioxide and water. What molecule did I just take in?
Oxygen.
Right, lots of different air molecules, one of them being oxygen. What carbon-containing material do we combust?
It's pretty practical.
Food.
All right, we all go up to the dining hall 3 times a day to fuel our metabolic engines. And what happens in us, of course, is that we're combusting that food. Do we combust it just like we saw that combustion here? We got a little flame inside of us that, right? What would happen if you ate a Pringle and that happened to it? What would happen to your throat? What do you think?
Be like a dragon.
Yeah, it might burn up, right? Right? So the thing about our combustion is that we do it stepwise. All right, we release a little bit of that combustion at a time. Right, are you doing visual demonstration of combustion? We want complete combustion over here. Thank you. I just wanted to end by saying, oh gosh, past my time, I've got a little bit of time left. I just wanted to end by taking a closer look at your combustion. fact that humans are chemical engines, combusting. Is glucose the only thing we combust? Other molecules, the fats, the proteins, and what have you? All right, so let's think about you as your chemical engine and your cell. Anybody remember where in the cell you're going to do this combustion?
Mitochondria,
right. So let's take a moment to get inside our cells. So the first thing to realize is how many cells you're made of. All right, so I once had a student do a calculation for me. He came up with the number 4 trillion. So the average human being has 4 trillion cells. You probably have maybe 2 trillion cells, right? So you think of your 2 trillion cells. Let's go to your liver where you get a lot of combustion going on and take a liver cell. If we take a liver cell as, what is your name?
Lindsay.
Lindsay said to us, all this combustion is happening in mitochondria. One very active liver cell has about 10,000 mitochondria. All right, so you might take a minute to think of yourself as 4 trillion cells, go down to your liver, grab hold of one of those liver cells, move into that liver cell and search around for mitochondria. You remember, may remember how you can find them. All right, we've only got a few in this cell, so let's talk about a liver cell. There's one there, there's one there. All right, so a good metaphor for your mitochondria are power plants. All right, and here is where the final steps in your combustion takes place. And even that is well characterized by the biochemists. What are the last couple of cycles that are involved in combustion? Who remembers that? You remember that, Lindsay?
The last two cycles?
Yeah. The electron transport system, that's the very last step, and the one right before that, the Krebs cycle, right? And you break down your sugar inside the cell in here, in glycolysis, and in here we have this final combustion going on to combust your food, all right? So I wanted to sort of end with this visual image because I know as I'm trying to hike up the Holden Lake, I'm thinking, go mitochondria, go, right? Burn that sugar in my bloodstream and give me the energy that I need to get up over that mountain. All right, so hopefully you can now take this little bit of information and use it to enhance your experience. The one idea we've been working with all week is the idea that where we know more, we see more. Right, and some of us yesterday had a phenomenal experience. In the morning, we started with the chemical perspective. And then we all congregated, just by accident, in the geology hike. Mm-hmm. So we ended up experiencing chemistry in the morning and the geology perspective. About halfway through the geology hike, I decided my brain was full. I really couldn't see anymore because I had so much information in my head. Right. So where we know more, we see more. All right. Would like to conclude for a moment by thinking about the theme, guide our feet. So what do you think? What are some connections we can make between this idea of where we know more, we see more, and our theme of guiding our feet? What do you think?
Explore more about God and know more about that. It has nothing to do with chemistry.
Okay, so you can't find a direct connection. Anybody think of a connection between that experience of God and chemistry?
God invented chemistry.
God's the greatest chemist. God's the greatest chemist.
It's a complete miracle, the reactions that happen in your cells, like just the complexity of them, just that happen like every day just for normal bodily functions.
That's right.
Pretty amazing.
We talked about an interesting idea yesterday. We had a pharmaceutical chemist in the room, and what he pointed out was, you know, here at Holden, when you smell the bread, you know what a feeling that is. Well, chemically what happens is that smell comes from a molecule striking your nose. And so that molecule originated where?
In the bread.
In that bread. And so when we smell that bread becomes a part of us, right? Mm-hmm. What happens when that mosquito bites you? Isn't that something? So the argument I'm trying to make this week is that this knowledge that helps us see more enhances our experience, as you suggested, the splendor and the majesty of the world. So, good. So enjoy.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.